This morning, I know I had said in my email that we were going to finish the end of 21 and move on to 22, and then I got in depth in 22, and even though it's a short chapter, there's so much to bring out of it, so I've decided to punt on the end of 21 and just focus on 22. So if that breaks your heart about Abimelech and Phicol and stuff, then see me after class, and I apologize, but I think we'll get a lot out of chapter 22. And I'm going on a family, hopefully. Susie gets better, we'll go on vacation this next week, and Ben's going to be teaching next Sunday for me, so I appreciate that. And I don't want him to have to finish 22 and try and do 23, because we only have a few classes left. So the other thing is, I know one class, if you were here, I told you basically I need to really press on and lecture somewhat, and then give you opportunities to speak, to comment, and that's today is going to be similar. I've got a lot that I'd like to cover. I know you're familiar with this text, and you want to add some comments too, so I will give you periodic opportunities, but bear with me. I apologize. It'll be a little bit more of a presentation than it is typically, just for the sake of time, so appreciate you understanding that. So I'd like to start by reading the text. So let's read the text together. Genesis chapter 22. After these things, God tested Abraham and said to him, Abraham, he said, here I am. He said, now take your son, your only son, Isaac, whom you love, and go into the land of Moriah. Offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains which I will tell you of. Abraham rose early in the morning and saddled his donkey and took two of his young men with him and Isaac his son. He split the wood for the burnt offering and rose up and went to the place which God had told him. On the third day, Abraham lifted up his eyes and saw the place far off. Abraham said to his young men, stay here with the donkey. The boy and I will go over there. We will worship and come back to you. Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it on Isaac, his son. He took in his hand the fire and the knife. They both went together. Isaac spoke to Abraham, his father, and said, my father. He said, here I am, my son. He said, here's the fire and the wood. Where is the lamb for a burnt offering? Abraham said, God will provide himself the lamb for a burnt offering, my son. So they both went together. They came to the place which God had told him of. Abraham built the altar there and laid the wood in order, bound Isaac his son, and laid him on the altar on the wood. Abraham stretched out his hand and took the knife to kill his son. Yahweh's angel called to him out of the sky and said, Abraham, Abraham. He said, here I am. He said, don't lay your hand on the boy or do anything to him. For now I know that you fear God, since you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me. Abraham lifted up his eyes and looked, and saw that behind him was a ram caught in the thicket by his horns. Abraham went and took the ram and offered him up for a burnt offering instead of his son. Abraham called the name of the place, Yahweh will provide. As it is said to this day, on Yahweh's mountain it will be provided. Yahweh's angel called to Abraham a second time out of the sky and said, I have sworn by myself, says Yahweh, because you have done this thing and have not withheld your son, your only son, that I will bless you greatly, and I will multiply your offspring greatly, like the stars of the heavens, and like the sand which is on the seashore. Your offspring will possess the gates of his enemies. All the nations of the earth will be blessed by your offspring, because you have obeyed my voice. So Abraham returned to his young men, and they rose up and went together to Beersheba. Abraham lived at Beersheba. After these things, Abraham was told, behold, Milcah, she also has borne children to your brother Nahor, Uz his firstborn, Buz his brother, Uz and Buz, that's pretty funny. Kemuel, the father of Aram, Chesed, Hazo, Pildash, Jidlaph, that's hard to say, Jidlaph, and Bethuel. Bethuel became the father of Rebekah. These eight Milcah bore to Nahor, Abraham's brother. His concubine, whose name was Rumah, also bore Teba, Gaham, Tehash, and Maka. So we'll spend most of our time in verses 20 through 22. Just a joke. We'll focus on the other things. The last part of the text is really just setting the stage for what's coming ahead. So that's the extent of what I'll talk about regarding those verses. Excuse me. Never mind. Thank you. He's got the magic touch. All right. So question one was, what is the difference between testing and tempting? What is the purpose of any test? So I will allow at this point, if you have some quick comments about that, then I'm going to go through quite a few texts to try and make an impression and make a point. So anyone, how would you respond to that? What's the difference between testing and tempting? Okay.
Where the goal of a temptation is for you to fail. So the goals are different.
Okay.
God tests us to give us an opportunity to grow, improve ourselves. Satan tempts us because he wants us to fail.
Very good. The source of those things are completely different. One is from Satan, temptation, and the other is from God, which is testing. So testing is a good thing. I don't know if you remember, a few weeks ago, I was probably preparing for going through this, and I talked about the purpose of a test or purpose of testing or something like that. So if you happen to read it, that gives you some thoughts there that I had about it. But any other comments about testing or tempting? No? Okay. So this is what I would describe as rapid fire. A lot of text we're going to look at. So bear with me, and I'll have brief comments, and then we'll just keep moving on. Okay? So we'll see if we can do that together. Blessed is the man who remains steadfast under trial, for when he has stood the test, he will receive the crown of life, which God has promised to those who love him. So faithfulness through trials and tests results in receiving God's promises. That's what James tells us. James 1, 13 to 15 says, "Let no one say when he is tempted, I am being tempted by God, for God cannot be tempted with evil, and he himself tempts no one. But each person is tempted when he is lured and enticed by his own desire. Then desire, when it is conceived, gives birth to sin, and sin, when it is fully grown, brings forth death." So temptation, as Stephanie pointed out, is associated with evil, and therefore not something that God would ever do to us. He delivers us from temptation. He does not put temptations in our path. That is Satan's domain, but testing is another story. Exodus 20 and 20, Moses said to the people, "Do not fear, for God has come to test you, that the fear of him may be before you, that you may not sin." So the purpose of God's testing the children of Israel under Moses was to create proper fear or awe, respect of him, so that they would not choose to sin. Deuteronomy 8, verse 2. "And you shall remember the whole way that the Lord your God has led you these 40 years in the wilderness, that he might humble you, testing you to know what is in your heart, whether you would keep his commandments or not." So God's purpose for the next generation in leading them through the wilderness for 40 years was to humble them and test what is in their heart, whether or not they would be like their unfaithful parents or if they were inclined to be obedient. A little later in chapter 8, verse 16, "Who fed you in the wilderness with manna that your fathers did not know, that he might humble you and test you to do you good in the end." So if you recall, even the provisions for food, they're out in the wilderness, not able to get food, were miraculously provided by God to help the people realize that he is the giver of all good gifts and be humbled thereby. The rules made regarding the gathering of the manna was to test whether they would be obedient. If you remember, they were to gather a day's worth every day, no more. And then on basically Friday, they were supposed to get twice as much and not do anything on the Sabbath, on Saturday. And it was a test they needed to do and trust God that he would provide every day the way he said he would. But the test, the ultimate purpose that God tests us is to do us good. It's to do us good in the end. That having gone through that test, that we'll be better for it. Judges chapter 2 verse 20 says, "So the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel, and he said, because this people have transgressed my covenant that I commanded their fathers and have not obeyed my voice, I will no longer drive out before them any of the nations that Joshua left when he died, in order to test Israel by them, whether they will take care to walk in the way of the Lord as their fathers did or not." So God had promised them that if they were faithful to him, that he would drive out all these enemies. Since they weren't, he left some of those people, and they became a stumbling block to the children of Israel due to their idolatry. It is an influence that they could have avoided, but instead had to endure a test to see if they would be faithful like their fathers or not. And of course, we know the story of Judges. They fail miserably. Just do not do well with that test. Psalm 7, verse 9. Oh, let the evil of the wicked come to an end, and may you establish the righteous. You who test the minds and hearts, O righteous God. So here the psalmist tells us that God tests the minds, he tests the hearts, and he is righteous in doing so. 11th Psalm, verse 5. The Lord tests the righteous, but his soul hates the wicked and the one who loves violence. So God's tests are primarily for his children, for those who are trying to be righteous. It isn't a punishment, but a form of discipline for his children. He loves his children enough to test them, but hates those who are wicked and love violence. Romans chapter 12 and verse 2 says, "Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind, that by testing you may discern what is the will of God, what is good and acceptable and perfect." So part of the process of transformation that we're to go through and putting off the old man of sin and becoming like Christ is through testing. Testing helps us to discern God's will, what is good, acceptable, and perfect. 2 Corinthians 2, verse 9, "For this is why I wrote, that I might test you and know whether you are obedient in everything." So if you remember, that's 2 Corinthians. 1 Corinthians, we had a brother who had his father's wife, and they weren't doing anything about it, so he commanded them to withdraw from that brother. And it was just as important for the ones doing the withdrawing as it was for the one that was withdrawn from. Thankfully, both worked out, where the one that was withdrawn from repented, and the people that withdrew from them passed the test. 2 Corinthians 13, "Examine yourself to see whether you are in the faith. Test yourselves. Or do you not realize this about yourselves, that Jesus Christ is in you? Unless indeed you fail to meet the test. I hope you will find out that we have not failed the test." So here we have the instructions to the church in Corinth that they should examine themselves and test themselves whether they are in the faith. And I think that is what we should be doing as well. We're constantly examining and testing ourselves. First Thessalonians 5:21 says, "But test everything, hold fast to what is good." So that should be our mindset, that we're always testing things. Anything that we want to participate in, we're testing it versus the scriptures. Can we do this? Should we do this? Right? That's what we're commanded to do, and cling to what is good. 1 Peter 1:7, "So that the tested genuineness of your faith, more precious than gold that perishes through, though it be tested by fire, may be found to result in praise and glory and honor at the revelation of Jesus Christ." So remember, Peter's audience is one that's being persecuted severely, and he's trying to put their trials and their tests into perspective. And he tells them that the testing of their faith is exceedingly precious because it will result in praise, glory, and honor to Christ. It isn't fun to get to be going through a testing like that, but in the end, it is worth everything. Revelation 2:10, "Do not fear what you're about to suffer. Behold, the devil is about to throw you, some of you, in prison, that you may be tested, and for 10 days you will have tribulation. Be faithful unto death, and I will give you the crown of life." Again, the Christians in Revelation are under severe persecution, and many of them martyrs. And he tells them that this is a test, and we are called to be faithful even unto death, that we can receive the gift of eternal life. "Beloved, do not be surprised at the fiery trial when it comes upon you to test you as though something strange were happening to you." And that's 1 Peter 4:12. So, how many times do we do a double take and scratch our heads and think, "Why me? Why is this happening?" When tests and trials come our way, we feel like we're being faithful, and yet we're not being rewarded like we thought we would, but yet feel like we're being punished. So I believe me, that's not an exhaustive list. I know it might have been exhausting for me to go through it that many, but my point is, this should not be a surprise to us. This is part of God's plan for all time, all of his people. Those that he loves, he is going to test. And it's part of his discipline, and if we focus and pass the test, we will be better for it, and ultimately be rewarded in doing so. So here's a passage, tying back to Abraham, that said to Christians, "Whoever loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me, and whoever loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me." So the love of family over the love of God is a test. It was very natural for Abraham to love Isaac exceedingly, given what he went through to have him and what he means to Abraham and Sarah and the promises that were made about him. He may have needed to be reminded of his greatest love, and same can be said of many of us. Physical sacrifices are given, as given in the Old Testament, mean nothing if not accompanied by the spiritual sacrifice of the giver. This is no less true in this case. God calls on Abraham to give up his son of promise physically to show that he still held God higher regard than Isaac and the promise he represents. The son God gave to Abraham was to be given back to God without reservation, which demonstrates a complete surrender to God's will. The inner spiritual sacrifice God truly desired was accomplished, though God stopped the physical sacrifice from occurring. Leopold says, "Abraham did not withhold his best, and God will bestow his best." Okay, this is the last slide for question number one. It is the longest one, but here's my point. God knows how we need to be tested. He knew Abraham's weak spot. He needed to test Abraham in this regard. And it specifically had to do with his family and his love of his family and his love specifically of his son, Isaac. The rich young ruler, if you remember that passage in Mark 10, Mark's account, we won't take the time to read it, but Mark's account says, first thing it says after the correspondence between Jesus and this rich young ruler is that he loved him. And he told him what he needed to do. And the issue he had was money. And to give up money became more important for him than obeying Christ. So God loved Abraham, and he loved the rich young ruler. And we have an example of one who passes the test and one that failed the test. So as the passage we looked at said, we need to examine ourselves. What would Jesus ask of you to give up for him? And it can be unique to all of us. And that takes some inner introspection to really think about it. Okay, I will leave it at that. So what comments do you have on that blitzkrieg of passages and thoughts about testing? The primary point is that it should not be a strange, as Peter said, it should not be a strange thing. When you're going through a test, this is what you should expect. And now look at it, as God's picking on you, God is improving you. He is helping you to become stronger. Okay, I need to be quiet. Any comments or thoughts that you'd like to share? Okay, I got a thumbs up. Thanks, Kim.
Well, the test is a confidence builder for you and for the one that's giving you the test. And even if you fail the test, hopefully it'll be a learning process and you'll come back stronger. I think that's what happened to Peter.
Yes, absolutely. Good example. So I appreciate that. I made that point in the thought for the week that the idea is we want to have tests, not just the final at the end. We stand before judgment, and that's our test. It's like, oh, we failed. No, we need to know ahead of time. We need to be having tests as we go. And like Peter, we may fail at times, but then learn from it and do better. So tests are a process of our spiritual growth. Yes, Stephanie.
I think it's interesting that
very good point. I do think that Abraham's a great example. As we've looked, he's failed different tests along the way, and this was a pretty great test, and he passed it. And yet Abraham, I believe if you were to ask him, he loves God, right? And but yet he fails these tests, but he passed this one. Peter was adamant that he loved God and would die for Christ. But then it took that test to realize, oh, maybe not. But then he grew from it and became who he became. So excellent points. Thank you. Kurt, go ahead.
So testing sometimes, when you take a test or tool, is to find out to what level have you been.
Right. Correct.
This part is just my opinion. It's the things that Abraham kind of messed up on, with Abimelech and Pharaoh and all of that. This test with Isaac seems to be way greater. So, test. We didn't do as well as we should have there. But the growth between
right.
Now I know. So it's very impressive. And so, if you think about yourself personally, where are the areas in which you struggle? And so probably keep getting tested on those things. So it's really could be used as a wake-up call for all of us sitting here today.
Absolutely. Okay, thank you for your thoughts. Let's move on to question number two. And I realize this may be a mind reading. I didn't mean it that way, but did you notice anything that was missing when Abraham was told to do the unthinkable? So before you answer that, let's go ahead and read Hebrews. Don't look at that. Hebrews 11, 17 to 19. By faith, Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac. And he who had received the promises was in the act of offering up his only son, of whom it was said, through Isaac shall your offspring be named. He considered that God was able even to raise him from the dead, from which, figuratively speaking, he did receive him back. So, what were your thoughts to the answer to that question? What was different about Abraham and how he responded? Any thoughts, Kim? Right. Yeah, that's along the lines I was talking about. Okay, very good. Well, that's pretty much what I had. He didn't question. He didn't argue. He didn't plead. And he didn't hesitate. And to Kurt's point, this is a pretty huge test. He argued or pleaded for Sodom and Gomorrah. He pleaded for Ishmael. I mean, you think about it, he's got a history of trying to be an advocate. I'm not saying it's a bad thing. It's just notably missing from this occurrence. He seems to accept it and act upon it. Now, we've talked many times in this class, and I hope it's made a point to you, is that he is a man of action. He does not hesitate. God tells him something to do, he's going to go do it. He's exemplary in that way. We often can't make sense of things, right? We can't figure out logically why this is happening or how this could possibly benefit me. And all too often, we quickly conclude that God is asking too much of us, or that because we can't reason things out, we must be right, he must be wrong. And I just cannot fathom the mental gymnastics that Abraham went through to become obedient to the command to kill his only son. So is he his only son? The passage says it several times, and Hebrews said it was his only son. In what sense is this his only son? It's his only son of promise. So anyway, you have to ask yourself, as we test ourselves and examine ourselves, how far will our faith take us to give God credit that he will always keep his promises, and whatever happens is ultimately for our good, even if that means the end of our lives? Well, how can the end of our life be for our good? Well, what example does it set for others? Hey, we end this life and we're faithful, where do we go? It's heaven. So we need to trust him. Anyway, I appreciate Abraham's mindset and perspective to be able to handle this great ask of God. Other comments? Take it.
Question in part. He didn't ask Isaac or the mother. So his decision was not to affect the mother.
Yeah, good point. I hadn't thought of that. Mike. Good thoughts. Thank you. Okay, this next section I'm going to lead because there's a lot, but I'll talk about something. You can chime in if you have anything to add to that one, then we'll move on. And then when I get done, you may come up with some others that I didn't think about. So you'll get your chance to add to this, but so the first thing is I noticed some parallels of God and Abraham. Okay, God and Abraham in this text specifically. So in chapter 22, verse 6, it says towards the end, they both went together. And in verse 8, so they both went together. And it struck me in studying the text this time that Abraham was being tested and suffered greatly at the thought of what he had to do to Isaac, that Abraham and Isaac were on this difficult journey together, right? And what we need to understand is that's talking about God and Christ. Christ, the one that sacrificed himself for us. But God was on that journey with him. They were one. They were together in that purpose. They knew what had to be done. And it was a test. Anyway, goes into the humanity of Christ and God's divine. I know that's different. But it was difficult for God, just like it was difficult for Abraham. So they did that together. Verse 2 says, now take your son, your only son whom you love, and offer him. Well, obviously, there's a parallel there between Isaac, Abraham giving up Isaac, and God giving up his only son. I should really look at my notes. They're much better stated than what I can do off the top of my head. God never asks his creation to do what he is not willing to do himself. Romans 8:32 says, he who did not spare his own son but gave him up for us all, how will he not also with him graciously give us all things? So he tests Abraham, but stops him. But he gave his only son and went through with it, in spite of that son begging for another way. And the last point, the offspring multiplied, verse 17. Abraham's willingness to give his only son caused him to receive many sons. God's willingness to give up his only son caused him to bring many sons to glory. Not just his own. So there's a parallel there as well. Okay, thoughts about that? Yes, Steph? Confident that I was difficult. Yeah, I agree. John 3:16-35, for God so loved the world that he gave his only son, that whoever believes in him should not perish but have eternal life. And the Father loves the Son and has given all things into his hand. So here's the motivation. God loves the Son but desired that all who believe in him to have eternal life. That was his ultimate goal. And that was only possible if Christ was sacrificed. So ultimately this act allows the Father to be reunited with his Son along with all the faithful of all time. As we've stated, by the death of one, he became the father of many. So any other parallels you see with God and Abraham? Mike? Hey, Mike, we're going to talk about the connections with Christ. I'm just talking about God. God and Abraham, that parallel.
Oh, okay.
And I'm going to lead us through the rest of it. So you got some good thoughts there. That's okay. But for the sake of time, I need to march us through this. And if you have anything to add, it'd be great. So parallels between Christ and Isaac. So Mike just brought up Mount Moriah. Okay, and if you don't know, it's an important place. So what strikes me here is that God told him where to go, okay? And this isn't a coincidence that history plays out this way. God intends this and knows what he's doing throughout time. So it's the same place where location where David offered a sacrifice to end the plague. If you remember that story from 2 Samuel 24, he numbered the people, and that was a result of his sin, and that's the location where he bought that place and offered sacrifices. So significant event. And it also happens to be the place where the temple was built, literally built at that same location. Now, if the temple is built at that location, Jesus wasn't crucified in the temple, right? So it's not the same exact point, but what I have read, it's on the same ridge, same mountain ridge. So it's the same mountain ridge as Mount Calvary, where Jesus was crucified. So there. The truth. So the phrase that's stated, on Yahweh's mountain, it will be provided. And you can see not only in this case with Abraham, but these cases. In these cases, that's where God provides. And that's the theme. Yahweh will provide. You'll notice they're both sons of Abraham. That's a pretty obvious one, maybe, but just making that observation. Matthew 1:1 says, the book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, son of David, son of Abraham. Verse 3, there were two others with them. There they crucified him, and with him two others on either side is Jesus between them. So John 19:18 talks about the criminals beside him. In this case, it's just Isaac and these two helpers. Excuse me. 22:4 talks about the third day. Luke 24:46, and said to them, "Thus it is written that the Christ should suffer and on the third day rise from the dead." So I want you to put yourself in Abraham's shoes and what you've been told. And now you have 3 long days to spend with your son, knowing what's coming. Even ordinary people can do great things in the spur of the moment, in the heat of the moment. But it's a testament to his faithfulness that he can think about what he's got to do for that period of time and not going back on what he was told to do. Verse 6, the woods laid on the sun. John 19:17, he went out bearing his own cross, the place called the place of the skull, which is in Aramaic called Golgotha. So in verse 5 and 6, Abraham refers to Isaac as a boy. But remember, how did the angel refer to Ishmael when he was about to die of thirst? And it was as a boy. And we know Ishmael was how old, approximately? It's about 17? Okay. So we don't know how old Isaac is. But we do know he was old enough to bear carrying wood for a period of time. He's also old enough to know, hey, there's something missing here. We don't have the lamb. So he's familiar enough to know the sacrifice process. So being strong enough to carry the wood, aware of what's normally would happen, I'm guessing he's probably a teenager, but I don't know. I'm not going to make an argument either way. But with the wood on his back, like a condemned man carrying his cross, I think is the what we should see in this. In 22:7, he says, "My Father." And he said, "Abba, Father, all things are possible for you. Remove this cup from me, yet not what I will, but what you will." So I want to contrast this. When Jesus says, "My Father," he knows what's going on. He knows perfectly what's going on. Isaac had no idea, no such idea. Okay. So even though the meanings behind them were very different, they're still the same statement, "My Father." So I just wanted to point that out. In verse 8, talks about God providing the lamb. So this innocent lamb idea. 1 Corinthians 5:7, cleanse out the old leaven that you may be a new lump as you are unleavened, for Christ our Passover lamb has been sacrificed. In Luke 22:7, then came the day of unleavened bread on which the Passover lamb had to be sacrificed. So we don't have time to go back to Exodus and talk about the Passover and all those connections there, but when if you want to look it up, it's Exodus 12:5-7, 12-13. But in verses 7 and 8, when Isaac asks, "Where is the lamb?" he knows something's missing, and Abraham's response is God will provide himself a lamb. And this response spares Isaac undue pain and leaves the issue entirely in the hands of God, where in his own heart he left them throughout the journey anyway. And Leopold made that observation, which I thought was worthy of sharing. In verse 9, he bound his son. John 18:12, so the band of soldiers and their captain and the officers of the Jews arrested Jesus and bound him. John 18:24, Annas then sent him bound to Caiaphas, the high priest. Jesus was bound voluntarily. We all know he could have stopped it, right? And I do not believe that what Isaac did was voluntary. Okay. Some will try and make the connection that making Isaac more like Christ, and that Isaac volunteered himself to be bound. So I believe this is one example of where the type or foreshadowing is not perfect, nor is intended to be. Isaac is not Christ. Christ's obedience was tested, Isaac was not. The text tells us that God tested Abraham, not Isaac, on this occasion. And Abraham is the focal point of this event, not Isaac. And then imagine if I'm wrong about that, and Isaac volunteered himself to be sacrificed. It's never mentioned. He's never praised for it. And yet it would be one of the most amazing testaments of faith to do so. For a kid, however old he is, to allow himself to be sacrificed. So the point is, some try to make everything be a connection, and I don't believe it is. I think this is about Abraham, not as much about Isaac in that regard. Now, I know that's a little bit more controversial. You may have a different opinion, so I'll give you a moment to disagree with me if you would like. Ben, go ahead.
I know we've talked about this before. I'm 100%, this is all Abraham. But having children, unless Jocelyn willingly allowed me to find her, I couldn't find her. I'd need more help. And so, in my mind, there had to be some willingness on Isaac's part to submit to Abraham.
Okay. So my thought or response to that would be, God will not tell us anything to do or command us something to do that we cannot do. When God told Abraham to bind his son, then I don't know if he all of a sudden got a burst of energy or what happened, but I know that he was capable of binding his son.
It would have been 110 at least.
Mm-hmm. I understand. And it's by faith that I believe that he had the power to bind his son because of the things I've already referenced. That, again, Hebrews doesn't talk about Isaac in this way. It doesn't even mention it. And, again, the text is about Abraham. So I will admit that I can't be dogmatic, even though I have a strong opinion about it, because many people try to make Isaac to be Christ in this example. But your point is duly noted. Go ahead, Jeff. Right. And I think there's a reason the parallels and the types is that he would be bound and offered. Mike.
There could be, and I just emphasize that could be a parallel, but two different things there. One, we are instructed to be Christ-like in our actions and our ways of life. So that means that Isaac could have been Christ-like in one particular way, and that could be, at this moment in time, very innocent. Mm-hmm.
Excellent point. Thank you. Any other comments about that? Yeah, go ahead. Oh, I'm sorry. Steph first, and then Ben. Go ahead. I appreciate that point, and the only caveat I'd put is that when I find parallels, most of them are about Christ and Isaac. In other words, I had three for God and Abraham, and then I've got a bunch for Christ and Isaac. So my point is that I do think a lot of these things are not by accident, right? So a lot of these things are meant to point us to Christ. I just think this is one that is a leap too far, I guess, is what I would say. Ben? Okay, so if he submitted to himself to his father by being bound, he asked him already, where's the sacrifice? I just wonder, what reason would there be to bind him? But we'll leave it at that. It's possible. Okay, we'll keep moving on. Thank you for your comments. I got one last one for the Christ. And obviously, it's a substitutionary sacrifice. If you look at the end of verse 13, Abraham went and took the ram and offered him up for a burnt offering instead of his son. In 1 John 4:10, and this is love, not that we have loved God, but that he loved us and sent his son to be the propitiation for our sins. So Christ, we understand, took our place. We deserve to die for our sins. He did not deserve to die since he was without sin. Yet he took that punishment for us. The ram was innocent, but allowed to die instead of Isaac, likewise. Christ was innocent but allowed to die instead of all of mankind. Okay, any other comments? Or maybe you came up with something else that I did not, about any parallels that you saw. Okay. What does God promise through his angel to Abraham since we passed the test? I know we only got a couple minutes, so I'm going to take over, sorry. Says, I will bless you greatly. I will multiply your offspring greatly. Your offspring will possess the gate of his enemies. All the nations of the earth will be blessed by your offspring. So first and foremost, Abraham is going to be blessed greatly due to his obedient faith. However, note the emphasis that is placed on his offspring. The very concern that was the test itself, loss of his only offspring, his promised offspring, becomes a source of great blessings for Abraham and ultimately to all of mankind. So through Abraham's offspring, all of these wonderful things continue to take place. Okay, and then quickly, what is the relationship between God's gracious promise and Abraham's obedience? 22:16 says, because you have done this and have not withheld your son, in 22:18, in your offspring shall all the nations of the earth be blessed because you have obeyed my voice. So there was an expectation, something Abraham did in obedience, in faithfulness to God. And because he did these things, God graciously granted him those promises. So they are both a component. And it's true of us as well. We're asked to do things, and if we're faithful to him, then he blesses us in various ways. And then as they're coming out, I got one last thing I'll add. For what it's worth, this struck me. I'd never looked at this before or noticed this before. But 22:1-7:11, Abraham says, here I am. And the first thing I think of, and I'm sure you probably think of too, here I am, send me. That's Isaiah, right? He had that attitude, I'll go. But Abraham says it on three different occasions in the short text, in response to the call of God in verse 1, Isaac in verse 7, Yahweh's angel in 22:11. So for what that's worth. And then he said, we will worship and come back to you. I assume that's a statement of faith. Abraham wasn't lying when he told the two men, hey, we're going to go worship and we'll come back to you. Okay, so I think it's a statement of faith rather than him lying about the situation. So thank you. We got through. I'm sorry we didn't have more time for comments, but I appreciate all that you've done. And again, Ben will take the next class. We'll do chapter 23 and go from there. Thank you.